The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And can everyone hear okay? Great. So one of my favorite verses from the Dhammapada, I haven't memorized it, but it goes something like this. That victory brings misery, as does losing, as does defeat. And a wise person is not involved in either victory or defeat. So the idea that, so I find myself occasionally watching a sports game, and I don't quite understand why there has to be a winner and a loser. And it doesn't quite make me happy. You know, it doesn't, you know, it's not like bring me joy to, because someone's going to lose. And I feel sorry for them. That's unfortunate. And so maybe I'm strange. But I didn't used to be strange. But I think it my strangeness grew over the years. In parallel to doing this Buddhist practice. So there are some risks involved in doing this practice, and that I should forewarn you about. You might find that you lose the appetite for battles, fighting and war, competition. You might find it uninteresting to end up being the person on top in the competition, victory, and better than everyone else, or getting your way, asserting yourself, and no longer interested in that doesn't mean that now you're interested in losing. Just give me a good battle to lose, that would be great. But rather to be interested in another possibility. And that is to look for the greater good for everyone involved, for the greater happiness of everyone. And so maybe it's silly to have this attitude towards sports games. But we have all kinds of strife in our society, in our world, whether it's very local, you know, within family or within neighborhoods or within places of work, or it's, you know, expands outward between people in society, between societies, between nations, all kinds of conflict that goes on. And in the world of conflict, in the world of, like, you know, the political sphere, and the, I think part of the currency, or part of the fuel, or part of the strategy, is to attain, to acquire power, and to have power to institute some kind of thing that we want. And the thing about power is that the people who have the power sometimes will make decisions for the people who don't have power. And sometimes people in power are infinitely wise, and they know exactly what everyone needs. And so everyone's going to be happy forever. It's just great. And they live happily ever after. Maybe that happens, but it's pretty rare. And it's very unfortunate that there are winners and losers in the political sphere, that people who feel like their agenda, their approach, gets the upper hand, and other people who feel like they're lost, they lost their dignity, their vow, their power, their efficacy, their values, many things, they get lost. And so the pendulum swings, you know, and so to have it be one or the other, winners and losers, it just doesn't make me happy. So tomorrow we have this election, and I certainly have my preferences about who's going to win, but I wish there was a different system. I wish there wasn't winners and losers this way, because I don't think it's very sane. I don't think it's helpful for bringing people together to look for the greater good for all of us. I've been involved in, I was a chair of an ethics committee for many years, 15 years or so. And so I had lots of occasion to work with ethical conflict. And then once I went to kind of a meeting of organizations that were similar to the one I was on the ethics committee for. It had kind of a national meeting to talk about what they had in common. And someone said, oh, we should have an ethics committee for all of us. Lording over all of us was the feeling of it. Who can make decisions. Who has the power to make decisions when, you know, decisions have to be made, like someone has done something unethical. Someone who has the power to come in and said, Gil, will you do that? And I said, no way. And so in this ethics committee that I served, I explicitly said, I don't have any power, I don't want any power whatsoever in this role. And but people would look towards the committee to have power because people would do things that were a little bit, you know, unusual, that upset people, hurt people. And then they get the phone call from the ethics committee. Uh-oh, I'm in trouble now. But my goal was to have no power and to rather be in conversation with people to see if we could find the common good, what was best for everyone concerned, given what happened. Not kind of prettying it over, not ignoring it, not lessening the hurt or lessening the challenge that happened, but be interested in the welfare for everyone involved. So my goal was that when people got the phone call from the ethics committee, they'd be happy. Oh, good. Now we get to be part of an interesting process. There'll be a good outcome from this. And what I found was that these kinds of challenges, ethical challenges people have, when people have different points of view, different needs, different concerns, different perspectives, that if people were not listened to, it didn't go well. But if everyone was listened to, and they felt respected and felt heard, things would go so much better. I remember once there was an ethics complaint, and the people who filed the complaint were a little bit marginal in a variety of ways. I won't say how. And so there were some of the people who were kind of running the ethics, then I wasn't kind of centrally involved in this particular case, who didn't really respect the people making the complaint. They thought it was not quite accurate, it wasn't really appropriate, or it wasn't kind of something real. You know, they thought it was kind of... So they did a kind of performa listening to them. And then kind of like, basically kind of said, there's nothing going on here. And the result of that was they just got angry and came back with, you know, great more adamancy, like really hurt and wanted something to happen. So it got pretty serious. Only then was I brought in. And so then I spent time listening to people and hearing them out and making sure they understood that I heard them. And just the fact that someone was interested in them and cared for them and listened to them out, heard them, they relaxed. It was like, that's what they needed. And then, you know, it was almost unnecessary to resolve the ethical issue anymore. Because the steam had gone out, the hurt had gone out, the disrespect they felt, that it was so stinging them so much, had kind of dissipated. So it doesn't always work that well, that all you have to do is listen and then things kind of go smoothly. But it's the starting point, just to really hear people out and find out what's going on. And then what's the common good, what's the greater good, what's the best for everyone involved, so that there is no winners and losers. There might be consequences, there might be things that have to happen, but everyone understands why it's happening and how this works, why this is really an attempt to be inclusive and take care of things. So the Buddhist approach, I hope, is not one of using power, not having power or authority, but rather having respect, care, compassion, and using the collective power of a community, a group of people, to speak and talk and understand each other and find their way. And sometimes it's messy finding our way together, but to hang in there with the challenges and slowly come to something where we find what we can do together. And, you know, I don't know much about the big political world, but in so many situations in my life, I've been in places where I've been in disagreement with people, one person or a small group of people. And we've had some pretty kind of strong, intense conversations, you know, back and forth. And at some point people will say, okay, you can have your way, or something. And I said, no. That's not how we do it. This is great that we're having this conversation. There's not any animosity here. There's not any criticism of each other. We just have a disagreement. And if we can hang in there and stay in the strong conversation we're having, it becomes creative. And maybe at some point we can find a third solution together. But unless we stay in the creative tension, the third option that we hadn't thought about that works for both of us is not going to have a chance to surface. If I win, we won't find the third option. If you win, we won't find the third option. But if we hang in with the tension that our disagreement has long enough, maybe something will pop up. We'll realize something. Because I've seen so many times that it's worked that way, if we hang in there. So power, having power to make decisions, is a lot more efficient in the short term. But the long term, to spend time talking and hearing and thinking and being with things until something else comes out is, you know, is pretty inefficient. And if you're not a patient person, it's, you know, then it's not going to work out. One of the great models for patience and waiting is Mahatma Gandhi spent, I don't know how long time he spent, but he was kind of trying to get the English to stop ruling all of India. And so he spent some time on retreat or in jail or thinking about what to do. And I think some of his people were impatient with him because we have to do something. And he was just kind of hanging out, thinking what to do. And then finally said, I know. Let's march to the sea and collect salt. It was like salt. You just go down to the supermarket and buy salt. But the English had a monopoly on salt, and no one else could buy it or harvest it or anything. And so that march was a very powerful, effective act of civil disobedience. And so he went down with his fingers and picked up salt on the seashore and was promptly arrested, and the English were never the same. So the idea that, you know, sometimes when you wait, sometimes you talk, sometimes you figure it out, is a very different model than using power over. So to use power with, or to use love. So there's a strong tendency in Buddhism, among Buddhist monastics down through the centuries, to refrain from being involved in politics. And it's not universal, and sometimes they've been very much involved in politics of the countries they're involved in, they live in. But there's sometimes a tendency to be removed from it, separate from it. And I think part of the reason for that is to avoid using power over other people. But the alternative to that is to use love, to use listening, to use teaching. So one attempt to the Buddhists have been to teach rather than to have power. I don't know if you know how effective it's been, the teaching thing, as a way of instituting social change. But kind of in this regard, and you know, my kind of distaste for winners and losers, my hope is that the role that Buddhism has in society is not to be involved in conflicts where there's winners and losers by taking one side or the other, but rather be seen as a mediating force. People who don't take sides, but who can step in and mediate the difficulties. And then spend the time that it takes to work things out and figure things out. But people not seen taking one side or the other. And who have the interest and the ability to look for this higher order of resolution, reconciliation, that's possible. And we certainly have examples of this in the modern world. It almost worked out in Colombia this year. And there were some people, there was a Norwegian. Norway has been very good at sending people around the world to try to mediate for peace in national conflicts. And they send people, Norway doesn't have to do this, but they have all these trained mediators, international mediators, and they go and they try to find peace between people. And they're done in Sri Lanka, I think some success there years ago. And there was one Norwegian who spent, I think, a very long time, a couple of decades, a decade, I don't know how long it was, working in Colombia, trying to find some kind of reconciliation between the rebels and the government. And it was apparently pretty intense for him. It was more than a full-time job, going back and forth, traveling, talking on the phone, trying to save the talks. And then it almost worked this year. They had an agreement, right? But then Colombia had a vote, and it got turned down by a small margin. And now they're back trying to figure out what to do next. But that model of coming in to do that, that's my dream, my wish of what Buddhism does. That we come forth in a different way than the winners and losers approach. That we come and try to find how everyone can be winners. And maybe you think, and maybe it is somewhat unrealistic to expect that in all areas, in all places. But wouldn't it be great to try to find out? Because we have a society, many people in the world even, who are trigger happy, who are very opinionated and very angry, and they want their way quickly and now. And sometimes they're quite happy to call on violence, even, to assert their way and get their way and have it done quickly. It's pretty much understood now that the instinct to punish people, criminals, in the way that's done in California and some of the states around the country, put people on death row, to give people serious long-term punishment. Department of Corrections used to be the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and then they decided to take out the rehabilitation part. What? Why? And California has one of the highest recidivism rates from the prisons in the country. More people who leave paroled from prisons in California end up going back than almost anywhere. Is that a successful prison system? They're successful in keeping prisoners in prison, but this is successful in terms of creating a safer society for us. And so so the instinct, you know, to do things quickly or violently or punishing turns out to be to backfire sooner or later. And it might seem like we're successful in the short term, but in the long term, it tends to create a society which, you know, doesn't promote the strong, the better values of our hearts. So this was a long introduction to what I want to read today, or tell you about. And so Buddhism does have advice to leaders. So in terms of being involved politically, offering some kind of teachings that they're supposed to create better leaders. And first, I think the Buddhist idea of political leadership is that it's leadership by consent. So whoever's a leader has received the power from the people, and they have, through the consent of the people, they govern, but that consent can be taken away. And that's kind of like what democracy is supposed to be. And so one of the things the Buddha said about advice he gave to leaders and how to be political leaders, kings back then, his time, was the number one thing to take care of if you were a king was the distribution of wealth to the needy, to the poor. That the poor had to be taken care of. They had to have enough food and shelter and work and things. And without the poor being taken care of, inevitably there was going to be violence in society. That's what the Buddha, kind of how he viewed things. So that's the primary responsibility of kings back then. The second is to have kind speech. So that's very nice, isn't it? But the thing about kind speech is that, and the problem with a lot of kindness, the kind things, is that it doesn't generate a lot of attention. I mean, you don't get headlines in the newspaper, you know, that publicize people's kind speech. So, so if people want attention, it's the opposite. And then there's wise conduct, which is Buddhist shorthand for living ethically. And then the fourth one is kind of what I've been talking about, a feeling for the common good. So concern for the common good, how to care for everyone. And not to assume that you know and your way is going to be the right thing for everyone. But how do we find the common good? How do we work with people who have different opinions from us and different ways and all that? And then there's a wonderful list of 10 qualities that a leader should have. And I like to think of these as qualities that everyone should have in America, because in America, being kind of a democracy and whatever, I think the idea is we're all supposed to be leaders. We're all supposed to have a civic responsibility that we're involved equally. So the idea of kind of giving up the authority to others to take care of things, I don't think really works so well. But in our own domain, in our way, to feel like, yes, we all have to contribute. And so what are the values that we live by if we're going to be civic leaders or civically involved in our society to make it better? And so there were 10 qualities. And I was invited once to a dinner, to have dinner with Denis Kucinich when he was running for president at someone's house. And he was, so I thought that was kind of nice. I kind of thought he was a cool candidate. And so I said, actually, I'll come to this woman's house for dinner. And I'd been to her house before, so it wasn't that big of a house. You know, it was a nice house, but it wasn't that big. So I'd been at her dinner table. It was kind of a big table, but so I said, okay, maybe there'll be about 12 of us there. And then she called me up a day or two before and said, will you kind of do the blessing before the meal? Because I'm the designated clergy. And so I said, well, sure. So I showed up, and she had tents in her yard, and people spread out everywhere, and it was like a political rally, you know, with, you know, fundraising or something. But There must have been 100 people there. And so I was asked to do the blessing. And Dennis Kucinich sat next to me. And so I read these 10 qualities. That I'll read to you in a moment. And he said he thought that was great. He wanted a copy. So I said, great, here. So I mean, I was happy to give it to him. And then I said, poor guy. These old people are always talking to him. I know what that's like. So why don't I'll just let him eat. Well, I was so naive, right? That was a mistake, because once he realized I wasn't going to talk to him, he was there to talk to people. So he got up and found someplace else. So anyway, that was my little, you know, naive entry into the world of politics. But anyway, here are the 10 qualities of they're called the Dasa Raja Dhamma, the Dharma of kings, of leaders. First one is generosity. And that's kind of like one of the prime virtues of Buddhism, cardinal ethical qualities of Buddhism, to practice generosity, to give. And that generosity is the leavening of society. It's going to keep society going and smoothly and friendly, and creates, you know, that's what creates good relationships among everyone, to people are generous. The second is ethics, to be ethical, to have ethical integrity, sila. And part of the idea in this Buddhist idea is that leaders are modeling what everyone else should be living. So if leaders model ethics, that spreads out. Then that's the kind of Buddhism had this a downward trickle philosophy of ethics, that if you're, the people on top are ethical, then everyone else is inspired to, or more likely to. And then the third is self-sacrifice. And the higher the level of political authority or leadership a person has, the greater the importance is to self-sacrifice, to not do it for oneself, not try to aggrandize oneself or benefit oneself through the position, but to really kind of sacrifice oneself for the welfare of others. And the fourth is honesty. And if the goal is to be in conversation and dialogue with everyone and find the common good together and creatively kind of stay in discussion, honesty, I think, is paramount, because you can't have respect for each other. You can't find and massage and work each other's conversation, you know, the challenges and difficulty without honest dialogue. Because you want the truth coming together to create new solutions. The fifth one is gentleness and kindness. And I think that if you're not using power to get your way, then if you want to find a way, I think you want to do something like gentleness or kindness, friendliness, where people want to listen to you and want to work with you and want to kind of, yes, we want to find something together. Yes, I understand what you're trying to do. Let's stay in there. But if we use aggression to get our way, then people are not going to want to cooperate. Self-control. So self-monitoring and self-control, so that there's not a tendency to act impulsively or to be do things that you say or do things you later regret. To make space in the mind and heart for wisdom and compassion and love to operate, rather than some of the kind of habitual impulses that might come out. And then along that regard, the seventh quality is non-anger. I remember when my sons were young, sometimes my older son was not acting in the way that was conducive to social family harmony. And so, you know, we had, you know, tried all kinds of ways to support him, help him, try to make it all the family work. And many things kind of worked. You have to be kind of creative. The thing about parenting, at least from our parenting, was that as soon as we thought we figured it out, like he was on to the next thing. We had to figure it all over. But every once in a while, in order to stop something from happening that was really disruptive, I used what I called my strong voice. And once I said to him, when he was, I don't know how old he was, but I said to him, if you don't stop what you're doing, I'm going to use my strong voice. And I said, if you don't stop what you're doing, I'm going to get angry, and then I'll use my strong voice. And he looked at me, he kind of cocked his head and looked at me and said, Dad, you're already angry. And then I wasn't angry anymore. But anyway, so sometimes, occasionally I'd use with strong voice, like, no, you can't do that, in a very strong, forceful voice, dominating voice, you know, small little kid, I'm, you know, towering over him. And then he'd stop what he was doing. And oh, good. That worked. Until the day where he turned to his younger brother and used the same voice to speak to him. And then I said, oh, no. What have I done? It was effective in the moment, but in the long term, what he internalized, what he learned was appropriate or that he could do from what I did was not very healthy. That kind of, you know, this was not a good idea. So one of the qualities here is non-anger. What do people learn when we act in angry ways? When we're angry, people learn how to be angry. It becomes normalized, it becomes accepted, it becomes something people think that this is what people do. When there's challenges, we get angry. So for leaders to practice non-anger. And then here's the next one, which is one of the cardinal virtues of Buddhism. At the heart of Buddhism is non-violence. It's so much the heart of Buddhism, there's an ancient teaching that non-violence is the Dharma is characterized by non-violence, non-harm, ahimsa. And this is all of Buddhism can be understood to arise out of the dedication to live a harmless life. And part of the reason why it's all of Buddhism can be seen coming out of that is that our suffering that we have, that Buddhism is meant to alleviate or end the suffering we have, is that the suffering we're trying to eliminate is the suffering we cause for ourselves by our attachments, our clinging, and things like that. And we're not living harmlessly if we're harming ourselves. So the dedication to live harmlessly is both a dedication to eliminate self-harm, but also harming other people as well. And so the idea of living for governments to live, to act non-violently, is a pretty high ideal. And, you know, I'm pretty inspired by Costa Rica having no army. I think it's the only country in the world that doesn't have an army. It'd be great if there are more countries like that. And then, because all these things are challenging, and it's challenging to find, to cooperate and work with people in a supportive way, the ninth quality is patience. The leader should have lots of patience. And then the final quality is non-obstruction, or non-opposition. And so this means that when you're a leader, you don't practice having opponents. You don't have opposition. You're not someone who obstructs other people or opposes other people, but rather you might have disagreements, you might have different ideas of what's supposed to happen, but you don't set up a sense of me versus them, but you try to find how to be together in a cooperative way. And maybe that's naive in some situations, maybe not possible in some situations, but that's the quality that we're looking for, which takes creativity, which takes a real dedication, takes patience. how do we operate in the world without having an opponent? So 10 qualities of a leader, of a ruler, that the Buddha offered. Are they still relevant? The Buddha must have thought they were relevant in his time. Are we now living in sophisticated times? From the primitive times 2,500 years ago when he lived, so they don't really apply anymore. Or they apply even more now, they're more important now. Occasionally I've watched Star Trek back to over the various times over my life, you know, episodes here and there. And one of the things that amazes me about Star Trek is they have all this wonderful technology, but they many times they seem to be totally psychologically primitive. I know, it's very disappointing. You know, you think that in a few hundred years from now, or whatever along in the future of Star Trek is supposed to take place, that we finally would have learned something about human psychology and how to get along and work together. But for us, I can tell, for the most part, there's, you know, not much improvement. And maybe it's a lack of creativity on the part of the script writers. Or maybe it doesn't make for good movies we need to identify with the characters, so they make it like us. Anyway, I think we have a lot of room in our society to become more sophisticated, more compassionate, more cooperative, more as a society, as individuals. And I think that my hope is that those people interested in the transformation that Buddhist practice brings about are interested in stepping into the world to be agents of peace, to try to, with confidence, step forward into the world with values that are enduring, values which can make a real difference, and to do so with tremendous confidence, so much confidence that even if the society around us becomes filled with conflict, filled with problems, that we're not overcome by that, we're not discouraged by that in some ways, or dismayed by it, or afraid with it, because our confidence in being able to step forward and live in the world out of the best values of our hearts carries the day. I think that confidence to live ethically and kindly and compassionately for the greater good for all is one of the strongest forces that we have. And if you have confidence in that, you won't be anxious or afraid of anything that goes on in society. And no matter what happens in this country, that have confidence that we can step up to it and meet it locally, nationally, anywhere we can, I think is something that can give us strength. And rather than if the country does go in all kinds of unusual, painful directions, that hopefully that inspires us to finally put our practice to the test, step forward and up and meet it with our mindfulness, with our compassion, with our care, with our ethical qualities that we have, with strength, rather than being squashed by it or pushed down by it or lost by it. When you have a practice like Buddhism, you'll never be lost. And you'll never be without something you can do, some way that you can respond. And that way, we all become leaders. And if you decide to become a leader, then remember these 10 qualities. Generosity, ethics, self-sacrifice, gentleness, self-control, non-anger, non-violence, patience, non-opposition, and gentleness. What did I say? I missed honesty? I knew I missed one. It's an honesty. Thank you. So So whoever wins tomorrow, let's care for the losers as well. Let's not forget about them. And whoever wins, let's send them the 10 qualities of a ruler. They probably could be good to remind them in case they forgot. So I wish you all well next couple of days. Thank you.